May it please the court.
Morning.
Good morning. There are three issues for the court to consider in this Freedom of Information Act case involving records concerning the Crandall Canyon mine disaster in Utah in August of 2007, in which six miners and three rescuers died, and concerning which there are current pending criminal and civil enforcement proceedings. And the issues before the court are the Department of Labor's invocation of Exemption 7A of the FOIA, Exemption 5 of the FOIA with respect to the Machen privilege, and the Department of Labor's decision not to process certain responsive records that had been processed for Utah American in a prior request and were the subject of prior litigation. With respect to Exemption 7, the initial question is whether or not these records meet the threshold of Exemption 7. And Utah American takes the position that the court's concern should be the status of the records at the time they were created. And that, of course, is completely erroneous, as the Supreme Court in John Doe Agency versus John Doe Corporation held, in which the court said, the question is not the status of the records at the time they were created. The question is the status of the records at the time the government responded to the FOIA request. Here, the government responded to the FOIA request in November of 2008. By that time, there had already been a referral to the Attorney General, who in turn referred the criminal matter to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Utah. And in July of 2008, MSHA, the Department of Labor's Mine Safety and Health Administration, had already issued civil penalties in the case and stated that its investigation was ongoing and that it anticipated that there would even be discovery as these civil penalties were being challenged. So there's no question that at the time the Department of Labor responded to the FOIA request, these records have been compiled for law enforcement purposes.
Could you explain what it means to compile in this context? I'm waiting for you to use that word, hoping that it wouldn't be necessary.
Your Honor,
it is, I think, and I don't get it.
Well, Your Honor,
the
Supreme Court in the John Doe case actually talked about compiling and said that the word compiling means gathering of the records. It doesn't mean creating.
No one ever has to create any records, right, in order to satisfy a FOIA request.
No, you don't have to. You don't have to create
records.
So it
seems to me that creating is not part of the universe here. The activities are gathering the information, in this case anyway, and then what's compiling?
Well,
once it's been gathered.
I think when it's being gathered, for example, when the IRT was taking the witness statements, they in fact, not for FOIA purposes, but at that time they were in fact creating records and they were gathering information and they were compiling information. But subsequently, the U.S. attorney...
Gathering and compiling are the same, is that what you're saying?
Under the John Doe decision, the Supreme Court said that essentially compiling means when the information is being brought together, perhaps that's a better word, for a particular purpose. And here there's no question that the documents at issue, these witness statements, were brought together for purposes of the criminal investigation and the civil investigation. So regardless
when
of...
When they were brought together, there was no criminal investigation, right?
When they were, I'm using the words brought together in the context of when the U.S. attorney asked for and received the witness statements that the independent review team had in fact created. The independent review team created those records because they interviewed witnesses and they wrote up their testimony. But then the U.S. attorney asked for those records, so they were brought to the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney compiled those records.
So they were compiled by the U.S. attorney now.
Well, they were, I think the word compiled, they were compiled in both instances. The word compiled is to gather the information. And I think the issue, Your Honor, is, and the Supreme Court, again, made this clear in John Doe, is what is the status of the records at the time the request is being made?
Can I just see if I can clarify exactly what happened here? The U.S. attorney asked for the records, is that right?
That's correct.
And the... And DOL assembled them and gathered them and sent them to the U.S. attorney. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And that is exactly what happened in Doe, isn't it? Exactly.
Yes.
So,
exactly.
And Doe uses the words assembled for law enforcement purposes and gathered interchangeably with compiled. And it says it doesn't have to be originally gathered or assembled as long as it is, by this time, has been gathered and assembled and sent to law enforcement.
Absolutely, Judge Garland. And so I think the issue is not the specific word, whether we use compiled or gathered or brought together. The issue is, where were these records at the time they were requested? And were they, in fact, being used in connection with a law enforcement proceeding? And in this case, there's no question that what they were. And therefore, these records easily satisfy the threshold of Exemption A. And then the court's analysis moves on to whether or not release of these witness statements would, in fact, interfere with these law enforcement proceedings. The Department of Labor submitted a declaration from the U.S. Attorney, Brett Tolman, and also submitted a declaration from an MSHA attorney, Derek Baxter, who was dealing with the civil enforcement proceedings. And both of those individuals said to release this category of information, witness statements, would interfere with their respective law enforcement proceedings because it would allow the potential for witness intimidation, the exact kind of harms that the Supreme Court found in the Robbins Tire case when dealing with the category of witness statements and NLRB proceedings. And the Supreme Court in Robbins Tire said, if you release these witness statements before the law enforcement proceeding goes forward, there is the potential for witness intimidation. There is the potential for witnesses to change their story. There's the potential for witness collaboration. All of this obviously involves a predictive judgment. What the district court did in this case was to put the government in a classic catch-22 situation. The district court said there's no evidence of intimidation, and therefore you can't rely on Exemption 7A. Well, the reason there was no intimidation is because the government had not released these statements. The fact that the witnesses' names had been released is not the end of the analysis, because there is nothing tying specific information to a specific witness. The IRT interviewed 59 witnesses. Now, it is unlikely that if somebody was inclined to engage in witness intimidation, that they would go and try and intimidate 59 witnesses. They would obviously want to know what witnesses gave the most damaging information. Those would be the witnesses that you would target if you were inclined to engage in witness intimidation. And by not revealing the witness statements, the substance of the statements, so there's nothing that's tied to a witness name, that has protected the witnesses. So to say that the government has to release information in order to have witness intimidation occur such that the government can then prove that release of the information resulted in witness intimidation is an untenable catch-22 to put the government in, because then the exemption at 7A protection has been lost. So the district court cited no cases that would require the government to show the concrete harm that it was reasonably predicting under this court's decision in Center for National Security Studies. So with respect to Exemption 7A, the district court clearly erred in ordering that this information should be released and that the government had failed to meet its burden. The district court also erred with respect to its decision under Exemption 5 and the Machen privilege.
Can I just ask about that? All the documents are covered by both privileges, is that right? There's no document that's covered by, in your view, that's covered by Machen that's not covered by Exemption 7, is that right?
That's true. And also, Your Honor, one thing that we did not point out in our brief, and I apologize, is that 7C also covers all of the documents covered by the Machen privilege.
What did the district court say about 7C?
The district court found that Utah American did not challenge the government's invocation of Exemption 7C and granted summary judgment for the government with respect to 7C. But, Your Honor, I urge this court to reach this issue because 7A, as the court knows, is temporal.
If we were to agree with you on 7A, we would not have to decide now Section 5. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But
you would like us to give an advisory opinion about what might happen sometime in the future after the investigation is over, when they may no longer be interested in the documents and request them again?
Your Honor,
is there any other way to put it than the way I put that question?
Your Honor, we think you could avoid having the case come back to this court again after the exemption.
We can announce all kinds of rules that might resolve things, but we usually try to take care to only decide the matter we have to decide.
Well, the court is correct. If the court decides the Exemption 7A issue because it is coextensive with Exemption 5, the court need not decide the issue. But should the court decide to reach the Exemption 5 issue because of the fact that, as I say, it may well be back here, we would simply point out that in Machen and United States versus Weber, there is no indication in either of those cases that the Machen privilege should be limited to aircraft investigations, safety investigations that involve national security. In fact, in the Badwar case, this court upheld the Machen privilege in a situation that did not involve national security because that case involved a request for documents pertaining to all aircraft, military aircraft crashes. But as we point out in our brief, there is absolutely no basis for concluding that this privilege should be limited to aircraft crashes, safety investigations concerning aircraft crashes, which may or may not have involved the death of an individual. But a safety investigation into a mine disaster where nine people died, that in that case, the district court erroneously found that the Machen privilege should not apply.
Would you go on to the third issue quickly?
Yes,
that
sir.
Is the issue involving the documents that were pending before Judge Roberts.
Yes, Your Honor. In that particular case, there was a request. Those are what we call the MSHA witness interview transcripts.
Yes, right.
And there had been a request by Utah American to MSHA for these specific documents. MSHA had responded, and then Utah American had filed a lawsuit about that response.
Yes, I know all that. The question is, what's the basis for the district court changed his mind, right? And the government, the other Utah now says that your argument about that this violates the first file document is forfeited, that you didn't raise it properly.
Your Honor, that's a very narrow issue about the first file rule, but we did argue that we did not have to engage in duplicative processing. That's in the Derek Baxter Vaughn Declaration. So the district court is erroneous when it says that the government provided no basis for processing these documents because in its original opinion, it recognized the basis.
Maybe the district court just thought it wasn't fair to have them wait all these years.
Well, Your Honor, what the district court did, I don't think I think the issue is not whether or not it's fair for them to have to wait, but whether or not it's fair for the government to have to engage in duplicative work. This court in Crooker versus Department of State.
Yeah, but in Crooker doesn't help you because in Crooker, as I recall, the documents were actually released, weren't they?
But that wasn't the basis. No, I don't believe so because I think Crooker stands for a proposition, which is that the government does not have to engage or courts in duplicative work. The Crooker court said specifically that it is abusive and a dissipation of agency and court resources to make and process a second claim. That's not tied to whether or not there was a release. Mm-hmm. That just says that you shouldn't have to do double work. And in the Crooker case, the Department of State had FBI documents. They referred them to the FBI. The FBI processed them and made a release. The requester came back to the Department of State and said, we want you to respond. We want you to give us the FBI documents. That's really no different, except for the fact that a release was involved. In this case, where the request went to MSHA, MSHA responded. Then they came to the Department of Labor, which is the agency that MSHA is a component of, and said, we want you to give us the MSHA interview transcripts that we've already requested from MSHA, got a response from MSHA, and have filed a lawsuit on those particular documents. It simply makes no sense under the FOIA to require the government or courts to engage in this
investigative work. Can I ask, in that lawsuit, the Vaughn Index, of which is in our joint appendix, the government listed 7A as the exemption for the documents, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And it also filed declarations by both Mr. Tolman and Mr. Baxter, similar to the ones at issue in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I would guess that if you were to win this case, and I'm not saying you were, that it would be a fortiori that you would win the other because the MSHA investigation specifically investigated not government employees, but the actual witnesses to the mine disaster. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But I want to emphasize here that The district court's decision with respect to these MSHA interview transcripts was, in essence, a default against the government. The district court did not actually find, as a matter of fact, that Exemption 7A could not apply to the MSHA interview transcripts. The court, in a footnote, said, I'm not making that determination. I don't think 7A would apply, but I'm not making that determination. I am finding that because the government did not, in its declaration, assert Exemption 7A for these duplicative documents, that the government has to release them. That's nothing short of a default against the government and clearly erroneous.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Michael Kleiss, and I'm representing Utah American Energy Incorporated, and with me at council table is Thomas C. Means. Your Honors, I think this case presents a particularly compelling case for disclosure of documents, not only because that's the policy underlying FOIA, which should be construed liberally
but there are exemptions. So why don't you move on to the exemptions?
Okay, the exemptions, which are to be narrowly construed, Your Honor, for Exemption 7, we agree with the district court that the government has not provided the kind of specific evidence necessary to show that disclosure of the
why
IRT.
Why isn't the U.S. Attorney's affidavit all they needed? What's left? What more did they need than the U.S. Attorney's affidavit?
Your Honor, the U.S. Attorney's affidavit raises a lot of generic points about potential for witness collusion.
What more should he have said in there that isn't there?
What he might have said but did not was that there was an atmosphere in the MSHA office that gave rise to concern that intimidation might occur, or that there was an atmosphere at the mine site that intimidation would occur, but he said nothing of that sort. He failed to take into account the fact that...
Excuse me, he said nothing of what sort?
Nothing specific about the work sites that were at issue here, that is the MSHA field office in the case of the IRT transcripts, or the actual mine site in the case of the MSHA transcripts.
That an example of what he might have said but didn't had the facts warranted it?
Well, he could have pointed to the history of labor relations, say, at the MSHA office.
What case requires him to do that? I mean, I know you might like that, but in fact, Supreme Court of Robbins Tyers says
categories.
It says the possibility of witness intimidation arises simply from the fact of pre-hearing disclosure. That's all you need. I can't find any case that says that an affidavit of this kind would be defective.
Well,
you haven't pointed me to one.
Your Honor, Robbins Tyers rested in part, at least, on concerns that were concerns about labor relations that were peculiar to the National Labor Relations Act, as embodied in the National Labor Relations Board's rules of procedure, whereas those do not apply here in the case of the Mine Act, where there is a strong public interest in gathering and disclosure of information concerning the causes of mine accidents and ways to prevent them. That's one of the countervailing public interests here that we think warrants disclosure of these transcripts.
Well, that's a timing question, though. That can all come out after the investigation and or prosecution is completed with respect to future mine accidents. That's a good argument against Exemption 5, but not a very good argument against Exemption 7.
Well, Your Honor, this court in Campbell versus Health and Human Services did say that the affidavits must show by more than conclusory statements that there's a reasonable likelihood of interference.
Well, how different is this than the affidavit which as the court describes it, is almost identical in the Juarez case. It was also described in very general terms.
It was described in general terms, Your Honor. That's correct. But one distinguishing point is that the affidavit in the Juarez case attested to the fact that the agency had gone page by page through all of the documents that were going to be disclosed and had concluded that there was no segregable information that was not protected by the privilege by the exemption. Here, on the other hand, we don't have an affidavit that attests to that kind of detailed review of the transcripts to show why at least
That would go to segregability, and the district court didn't mention that word. Right? The district court just dropped, required disclosure across the board. It didn't say the reason was there was no evidence about segregability.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
And in several of our cases, we've said that we presume that the government understands its obligations with respect to segregability. That's what we said in Boyd. And in this case, the government, the U.S. Attorney's Office does say that even redacted versions would provide potential targets of the investigation with a much better understanding of the possible focus and which witnesses are likely to have knowledge of which violations. That's in paragraph 13.
Yes, Your Honor, but that does not take into account the further factor here that both the IRT report and the MSHA investigative report have been published. They were published in 2008.
Okay, so those don't say which witness said what. Is that right?
For the most part, they don't.
And to the extent that they do, the government actually gave you the witness statements.
I beg your pardon?
And to the extent that they do, the government actually gave you those witness statements.
Gave us the excerpts, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Well, if I may address the Machen privilege, because I'm not sure whether I understood Ms. Braswell correctly to say that all of the transcripts here were covered by that privilege. But
I think what she said was that anything that they said was covered by 7A, that there was nothing that was covered by Exemption 5 that wasn't also covered by 7A.
Oh, yes. Okay. So only 12 of the 59 transcripts were covered by the Machen argument. And our view about Machen is that it does, in fact, rely very strongly on the national security interest that was present in the Weber aircraft case and also in the Machen case.
Didn't itself. It have the word perhaps before national security?
Beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Didn't it have the word perhaps before national security?
Perhaps even, yes.
I left one word out.
I believe it did, but
given that, it's pretty hard to argue that that's what the case relied on. I mean, it mentioned it as an additional factor.
This is an important governmental interest, right? Perhaps even that.
Perhaps even, yeah.
But the interest in national security, that type of interest, cut against disclosure, whereas under the Mine Safety and Health Act, there are several provisions that direct the Department of Labor to gather information about the causes and ways of preventing mine accidents. So absent in those cases, the Machen cases, was this countervailing interest in disclosing information, and it's a public interest. It's not just an interest that Utah American Energy has. It's a general public interest in furthering the goal of the Mine Safety and Health Act.
Well, which furthers the goal depends upon whether the information would be produced absent the privilege. And in Weber, the court said, no, it wouldn't be. Privilege was what elicited the information. So there's no loss to the public if that information is not revealed. In other words, if the privilege is not overridden.
But there is a loss to the public here, Your Honor, and I think that's the...
Well, how is it any different? You have assurances of confidentiality and reason to think that without those assurances, the information would not be forthcoming. So maybe you mean for this case, but going forward, there would never be any more information if those premises are correct.
Well, Your Honor, the interesting thing about this case, though, is that of 47 of the 59 interviews were conducted without an assurance of confidentiality. And yet the agency is not complaining that the witnesses there were not forthcoming or that the interviews were not somehow complete.
Do you think you might have a stronger argument with respect to the IRT interviews than the MSHA interviews in the following sense, that the MSHA interviews are about and may be necessary in order to determine whether a disaster occurred, but the IRT interviews are about whether the agency itself made mistakes. And if we were to find a Machen exemption here, an agency could cover up its own mistakes and never have them disclosed simply by following, you know, by granting confidentiality to its own employees.
Yes, Your Honor, that is certainly a concern because the IRT investigation itself, and that's the reason that we raised the argument about not being compiled for a law enforcement purpose.
Well, you don't, that's different than the Machen argument, right?
But it's different than the Machen argument, but it's common ground to both of them because a ruling in this case that would sanction withholding the IRT transcripts really defeats the purpose of FOIA, which is to inform the public about how its government agencies are operating.
But this problem of the compiling is eliminated by the Doe versus Doe case for the purposes of Section 7, but might not be eliminated for your argument about Machen. That is, you might have a good argument under Section 7 about IRT, but for the fact that the U.S. Attorney asked them to compile the information for him. But that fact doesn't interfere with your Machen argument, right? Your Machen argument is independent and could kick in after the Section 7, Exemption 7. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. But to touch on the compile point for just a minute, we too have puzzled over what the John Doe agency decision really meant when it said compiled. But the best timeline that we can assemble from this record is that the FOIA requests were filed on August 14th and 18th of 2008. And according to the Baxter Declaration, it was not until August 27th, 2008, nearly 2 weeks after the filing of the first FOIA request, that the U.S. Attorney specifically requested that the IRT transcripts be included in or be excluded from or be included in the material that it was requesting from the agency. So we think it's a fairly it's a close call here. When the relevant compilation took place for terms of that for purposes of that threshold question under 7.
Could you go on to the third issue, and that is the question of the document of the FOIA request that's pending before the other district judge, and just explain to us, if you could, why the district court wasn't absolutely right the first time around, which is that, you know, he says judicial efficiency alone would mitigate against this, quote, curious request. I mean, to me, it looks just like what happened here was is that the district court, for some reason, just reached out and decided a case that was fully briefed and pending before a different district judge. Right? Isn't that what happened?
Well, Your Honor, the earlier case was only filed 3 days before.
That's what I said. A previously filed district court case, and you didn't indicate that it was a related case. I mean, you had control over this, right? You could have checked the related case box and avoided this entire problem.
We don't believe it is a related case because there were separate FOIA requests filed a year apart.
Is what the district court did even more inappropriate then, to reach out and decide this case?
No, Your Honor, because our FOIA request, both FOIA requests clearly encompassed the MSHA transcripts. Our complaints in both cases did. There are portions of the government's briefs in this case that treat the MSHA transcripts as though they are at play in this case as well as in the other case.
So apart from being in part the same dispute, they're not related cases?
There is overlapping material sought in both cases, but it's two different agencies for FOIA purposes.
Why do you say that they're two different agencies for FOIA purposes? You can submit requests, but there's no doubt that the MSHA is controlled by the Department of Labor, isn't that right? It's an entity, it's a component of the Department of Labor.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
So imagine that the MSHA transcripts were actually located in five different offices in the Department of Labor. Could you request from each office, sue each one, and depending on which district court judge you got, pursue one and not another?
No, I don't think you could do that, Your Honor.
So then why is this really different here when you're really asking for the same documents from the same parent agency? How can it be? What if the other district court decides the other way? What if the other district court, while we're speaking, announces that these are all clearly Section 7, Exemption 7 documents, as actually happened in, the Ahern case, at least as to one of them?
Well, I suppose we'd be back up here before you again.
Yeah, exactly.
That's sitting at a different table.
That's exactly why I think the district court was probably right when he said judicial efficiency the first time around mitigates against this curious request. Right?
But no, Your Honor, because the other case is
You just made his point.
Your Honor, the other case.
Not only are you going to have two district court proceedings, you're going to have two D.C. Circuit proceedings.
The other case is proceeding at a much slower pace.
That I understand. I understand that, but it can't be that one district judge can simply reach out and decide another district judge's case because that case is pending too slowly. I mean, you could have moved before Judge Roberts to ask him to decide the case, right?
We've fully briefed summary judgment motions over there in the other case, Your Honor, and he has denied both of them, and the agency is conducting a further search, after which we will then refile summary judgment motions if need be.
Yeah, isn't that the way it's supposed to work? It sounds to me like that's exactly the right process.
Well,
what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with it, Your Honor. It's just that we're trying to get a speedy decision on.
Even if that were okay for the judge to decide that issue, I'm puzzled by how it's okay to do what I think what the opposing counsel correctly described as basically defaulting the government. The government had, in fact, labeled these as sections as Exemption 7 documents in the other case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they submitted very similar affidavits in the other case.
Yes, Your Honor.
So wasn't the district court obliged to at least address the Exemption 7 argument before saying that the government has to turn them over? How can the court simply say that, particularly since, well, let me just pause, let me interrupt my own train of thought for one moment. It's correct that the argument is somewhat different for the interviews of the minors than it is for the interviews of the MSHA employees, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how can the district court simply default the government with respect to the interviews of the minors without giving the government a chance to at least argue the point in front of it?
We placed the Vaughn Index from the other case before Judge Leon in this case.
Right.
And we are not arguing and never have argued that the Labor Department was under any kind of duty to process that same material twice because its component agency had already processed it once. So the rationales that the government gives no reason why the rationales that it raised in the other case do not apply here to the withholding of the MSHA transcript.
So, in fact, I realize from your brief, you actually do argue that that Judge Leon had before him everything necessary to decide the Exemption 7 issue. That is, he had the affidavits and he had the argument about Exemption 7, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But he didn't.
Well, in a footnote in his opinion, or his memorandum opinion on the Rule 59E motion, he does say that even if the government were to proffer those same kinds of defenses, I would reject them because they're the same defenses that and basis for exemptions that I'm rejecting here. The government did have the opportunity in this case they could have moved to strike our filing of those the Vaughan Declaration and the Vaughan Index, or they could have supplemented and said.
But why did they need to do that? Their argument to the district court was this case is pending before a different district judge. That was their argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
But actually, can I'm looking at the footnote you were just referring to. The district court didn't actually say that he was finding for the same reason that it wouldn't apply. He said it is likely that DOL would fail to meet its burden. Nevertheless, because this court finds that DOL failed to meet its burden by not providing any explanation for nondisclosure, this court need not address whether any exemptions are applicable here. So the district court really did not even decide the exemptions. I keep calling it Section 7, I'm sorry. The Exemption 7 question with respect to the MSHA documents. That's right, isn't it?
I think that, yes, that's the way the footnote reads. So one possible remedy here is for the court to remand and have the district court engaged in that kind of analysis.
And I take it your view also is that since this is de novo and since the affidavits and the Vaughan Index are before it, we could decide that just as well as we could decide the other. We could decide the MSHA issue just as well as we could decide the IRT issue. In fact, you're basically saying we can do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Does Ms. Braswell have any time left? Okay.
I would like to talk to
her. Yeah, I was going to give her two minutes. Is that?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead. You can take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Braswell, the affidavit of the U.S. Attorney, I think, quite usefully creates three categories of documents or establishes three categories of documents. Two of them have just one document each in them, I think.
I think that's correct, Your
Honor. One involves an interview with a BLM employee.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what reason is there to think that the concerns raised about the large category, interviews with MSHA employees who recount what they learned from Utah American employees, what reason is there to think that the BLM employee poses the same difficulty?
Well, Your Honor, I think that, and I'm sorry, I did not look at that specific interview, but I think that that interview as an IRT interview has the same kind of concerns.
Well, the concerns, though, the IRT is interviewing MSHA employees, right?
Right.
But that might be innocuous in itself, but those MSHA employees are recounting things that they learned at the mine site about who said what and who did what, which, according to the U.S. Attorney, if revealed, would enable the employer, perhaps, to affect or frustrate its case. Any reason to think, I didn't even see an assertion, that the BLM employee was recounting things learned from potentially intimidatable Utah American employees?
Your Honor, I don't know if the BLM transcript has information from other employees, but as this court knows in the Tolman affidavit, the concerns go beyond intimidation. The concerns also go that release of the witness transcripts could reveal what the government is focusing on, the direction the government's investigation is taking. So I don't...
Well, is there any reason to think that that's specifically true with regard to the BLM employee?
I think there is, Your Honor.
I don't have any concept of what was discussed there, and I gather you're not familiar with it either.
I have not read the transcript, but even if I had, I wouldn't be able to say what was in it, Your Honor, because it's been withheld. So I think you have to look at...
You could say that there might be material in there that doesn't seem to trigger these concerns.
Your Honor, I wouldn't be able to say that because the U.S. attorney knows what its investigation is focusing on, and there might be something in a declaration.
Okay, but what I'm saying is the justifications he offered about witness intimidation, about collaboration, getting stories straight, seems all to be framed with reference to Category 3, which are Utah American employees indirectly. It doesn't seem to be framed, those objections, in any way specific to the BLM interview or to the second category, which was an interview with, that was the second category, the first category, which was an interview with an accident investigation team member.
I think, I disagree, Your Honor, because in both those situations, there's a potential, depending upon what is in the witness statement, that those individuals could be intimidated by what they found, what they say they found, et cetera. They may have reported what they found and who they think is culpable for what they found. So there is the potential for witness intimidation with respect to those transcripts.
You don't think any more specification here is necessary under the case law? Because it might be readily possible to segregate any such material. The Tolman affidavit is quite a bit more forthcoming or let's say detailed when it deals with Category 3. The paragraphs are much longer. It lists the 21 interviewees and so on, all of whom are Utah American, MSHA employees, all of whom talked with Utah American people.
But the Supreme Court in Robbins Tyre held that the government may make categorical determinations about types of records and make categorical determinations about harm.
Yes, and Mr. Tolman makes three categories. But I'm saying what he says about the first two is rather sketchy or conclusory.
But there's nothing more that he can say, Your Honor, without revealing either information that they're trying to protect. So,
I thought you might refer us to Mr. Baxter's affidavit, which refers specifically to the accident team's materials and to the BLM materials.
And I believe, Your Honor, with respect to Mr. Baxter, he's very clear that release of that information could impinge
on... he explains that his is part of a civil law enforcement.
The civil law enforcement proceedings, that's correct.
He has a paragraph discussing the accident team's investigation and why those have to... Two, actually... and a paragraph explaining why the BLM investigation has to be withheld.
And he explains in both cases, Your Honor, that release of that information could harm the civil enforcement proceedings. So when you look at those declarations together, they provide a sufficient record by the government of why release of this information could harm ongoing law enforcement proceedings that are both civil and criminal. I do want to make just a couple of other brief points, if I might. The Utah American Council said that the declaration in this case is not similar to the declaration in Juarez. And yet, if you look at the Vaughn Index in this case, you will see that even though the government is talking about categories of documents, the government went through page by page, line by line. So each page was bait stamped, and you will notice, for example, even if you look at just Joint Appendix at page 97, that the government says that all of the witness transcript is being withheld under Exemption 7A because of the criminal investigation, but only certain portions of the transcript is being withheld under 7A because of the civil enforcement proceedings. And they identify by line which parts of those statements pertain to the civil enforcement proceedings.
Why don't you go on and quickly make your last point?
And just before you do, where was that to be found? Sorry.
That was, Your Honor, it's throughout the Vaughn Index, but I was referring to page 97 in particular. And
JA 97? When you said page 97?
Yes, I'm sorry. Joint Appendix 97, Your Honor. With respect to, if I might just address Judge Garland's concern for one moment, Your Honor, about the Machen privilege and that the concern Judge Garland had that the government could simply grant confidentiality to anyone it was talking to in a safety investigation and thereby hide government mistakes. I think that that consideration was weighed by the court in Machen and the court in United States versus Weber, and the court found that the need to have these safety investigations, which were important government programs, warranted allowing withholding the information that had been gained under a promise of confidentiality because of the need to try and improve government efficiency with respect to an important government program. If the court has
no
further questions.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.